Hi, everybody. I'm Scott.
Hello, I'm Julie.
And this is A Good Story is Hard to Find podcast,
where two Catholic friends talk about the books and movies they love and the traces of the one reality that lie below the surface.
Yeah. And this is the beginning of year number 5.
Wow.
No, wait. Yeah. We went through this at the end of last year. We have a very special guest with us today to talk about Star Wars. Our guest is John C. Wright, who is a retired attorney, newspaper man, and newspaper editor, who was only once on the lam and forced to hide from the police who did not admire his newspaper. In 1984, graduated from St. John's College in Annapolis, home of the Great Books Program. In 1987, he graduated from the College of William and Mary's Law School, going from the third oldest to the second oldest school in continuous use in the United States, and was admitted to the practice of law in 3 jurisdictions, New York in May of 1989, Maryland in December of 1990.
You don't need to give your listeners the dates.
Okay. His law practice was unsuccessful enough to drive him into bankruptcy soon after. His stint as a newspaper man for St. Mary's Today was far more rewarding spiritually. I added far in there. But alas, also a failure financially. He presently works successfully as a writer in Virginia, where he lives in fairy tale-like happiness with his wife, the authoress L. Jaji Lamplighter, and their 4 children, Ping Ping, Orville, Wilbur, and Just Wright. Welcome, John C. Wright. Thank you for being here.
A pleasure to be here.
Wonderful. So you write books.
So you have these episodes. Is there anything you want to tell me about these episodes you have? And you don't remember the year?
We've been struggling, pushing this boulder up a hill since 2011.
A Sisyphean task.
Yes,
I actually have a day job. I write computer manuals, and at night I put on my Batman outfit and sit before the computer and write science fiction.
Excellent.
On the sly.
Mm-hmm.
So, and if my secret identity were revealed, then my effectiveness as a science fiction writer would be eliminated, of course.
Well, we won't tell anybody.
No, that makes no sense at all.
So, what a heck of a year for you last year. Record-setting number of Hugo nominations.
So I got 6, which was a historical, history-breaking record. One of them was disqualified on a technicality.
Mm-hmm.
So 5 is equal. There's another person who a few years ago got 5.
Well, congratulations on that.
Yes.
Well, thank you. Mm.
And what have you got on tap this year?
I have 2 publishers, a large major New York publisher and a really small, microscopically small Finnish publisher. And my New York publisher publishes in using matter with books, and my Finnish publisher publishes using electrons.
Mm.
So you can only read it if you have a special device. I have the book coming out from New York is called Vindication of Man, which is the 5th book in my Count to a Trillion trilogy, which is going to be a 6-book trilogy. As you can see, math is not my strong suit.
I'm glad you're counting to a trillion then.
Yes, well, there was a book that came to me in a dream about a week after I converted to Christianity. And I wrote the notes for the whole thing in one sitting. And only this last autumn did I have enough free time to put other writing projects aside, and I was also unemployed at the time, and I wrote the book all in one sitting. And my devoted wife prayed, and thanks to her prayers, we happened to have, just by coincidence or the generosity of friends and fans, enough money to pay all our bills with no problem.
Wow.
I've since gotten another job, and it's a very fine job. It's one of my favorite day job I've had so far. But that book was my attempt to do a Charles Williams-style book, that is to say a metaphysical thriller where the main character, it's not a whodunit, it's a what is it. It's a main character trying to figure out what the nature of reality is, because reality seems to have been broken or skewed somehow, or maybe he just has a bad memory. the premise of Iron Chamber of Memory is that he's in love with a woman who is going to marry his best friend, but he only remembers his love when he's in a certain chamber in the friend's mansion on the island of Psyche in the I'm mispronouncing the name. There's an island in the English Channel where lights outdoors at night are forbidden, and they still have a feudal system of government. And I'm not making the island up. I didn't make the setting up. I made everything else up. There's no motor vehicles are allowed on the road. The road, the one road.
Wow.
I'm exaggerating.
That sounds fascinating to me.
I want to go see.
I'm exaggerating slightly. I believe in 2008, a millionaire newspaper man persuaded the government to stop the feudal system of government and institute something more like a democratic election. But up until that time, it's a real place. The island of, and I can't pronounce the name, Sark, the island of Sark.
All right. Well, that sounds excellent. And there was one other you mentioned at the beginning called Moths and Cobwebs.
Oh, I'm starting a new four-book trilogy called Moths and Cobwebs. I'm kidding. I know that four books are actually called a quadrilogy.
Bonus books.
Yeah.
I wrote a short story for Feasts and Seasons that was so popular that I wanted to write something else in that background.
Oh.
And the idea is that there's a family called the Moth family, which are descended from the fairies, descended from the elves, and they are so numerous. They exist in all nations, and they always help each other out. But some of them intermarry with things that you don't normally intermarry with, like mermaids or giants or other things that are hidden from mankind. And the main character, Gilberic Moth, is a boy who doesn't know who his father is, who wants to be a knight, even though knighthood is not really in demand that much in the modern day. So that's what the end of he talks to dogs and they talk back to him. He hears them at least. So that's my attempt to try to write a juvenile. Try to write something.
I'm gonna read it. Could read.
Nice.
I'll send you the unfinished copy. I should finish it sometime this month or next month.
Hmm.
Wonderful.
That's great.
Well, cool. Well, thank you again for being here, year number this is.
Mr. Danielson, I hate to say it, but I'm not actually there. This is just an electronic.
Well, here in a virtual sense.
Yes, I'm virtually there. And I'm virtually glad to virtually be here.
We're all virtually there, man.
Oh, shoot. So, when we approached you with the possibility of being on this podcast, you suggested Star Wars as a possible topic for us to talk about. Besides the fact that it just came out,
I did go to see it. I did go to see the new Star Wars, Star Wars number 7.
We did too. Specifically, we listed this as talking about the first movie, but we definitely want to talk about the new one as well.
Well, my legal background has made me used to hostile questions from interlocutors. So if you have a specific question I can answer, that's easier for me than just because I'll go off on a tangent if I start talking on my own.
We'll start then and you can jump in and pretend it's a question. Because I can't believe we haven't talked about Star Wars in 5 or 6 years, whatever it is, of doing this. Lots of Star Trek, but no Star Wars.
Well, in that case, let me jump in with this idea, because as a science fiction guy, I've been a science fiction guy my whole life. I've wanted to be a science fiction writer since I was like 9, okay? And science fiction was a small ghetto up until the late 70s when Star Wars came out. And Star Wars is the thing that changed science fiction from being a small ghetto of losers to making all the losers, people like me, just mainstream throughout the entire society. I now can listen to like conservative talk radio guys who make casual references to Mordor and Mr. Spock and other things that back in my youth only the small science fiction community ever referred to. And I think we owe it all to George Lucas. We owe it all to Star Wars making science fiction respectable in the public eye.
Yeah, and I have to agree. I hadn't thought of it quite that way. But the other thing that occurs to me is I was looking into the science fiction that had come out in movie form around that time. I was like, I know why everybody embraced it. It wasn't Logan's Run. It wasn't The Planet of the Apes. It wasn't 2001 A Space Odyssey. It wasn't Fahrenheit 451. It was something that was optimistic and uplifting, and we were allowed to fight the bad guys, and we weren't just going to... I mean, I love those other movies, but they were kind of downers, you know? But
they're all grim. They're all dismal movies. Yeah. At the end of the Planet of the Apes, you find out the Earth is destroyed. At the end of the sequel to Planet of the Apes, they blow up the entire planet, and then they made a sequel beyond that, showing that they're awesome. But always a downer. Logan's Run, downer. Yes, you're exactly right.
So.
Yeah, indeed. Indeed. I was wee when it came out, 8 years old. I believe that, I don't know if I saw it on its first release either, but I remember my father taking me to it. But yeah, it was a life changer. What is 13, the golden age of science fiction? But it pretty much, Star Trek and Star Wars brought me to science fiction reading.
Yeah.
When the first Star Trek movie came out, I saw it on its on the opening day. It was not one of the, it was not a very good movie in terms of Star Trek movies. But I sat there in the theater and I watched it and I said, "This is because of George Lucas. If he had not had hit the ball out of the park, if he had not made a mint with Star Wars, this movie would never be made." Yeah. And I said the same thing when I went to go see, I forget what it was, like Jupiter Ascending, which was just a science fiction spectacular spectacle. And I said, that's all George Lucas. That's all on him.
I want to see.
I feel we owe him a great debt of gratitude. I still don't forgive him for Jar Jar Binks, but we owe him a great debt of gratitude.
Well, yes, now, indeed. So did you see Star Wars on a first release?
I mean, I did indeed.
What was your experience? Because I'm going to tell
like Mr. Danielson not being able to remember what year this is. I don't remember my age or what age I was at the time. I mean, I could tell you what other science fiction books I was reading and what the names of the characters in those books were and what they said and quote dialogue. But I can't tell you things like the names of members of my family, my phone number, or anything else.
Well, what I can say then, since I'm dying to talk about it and everybody wants to hear about me going to Star Wars.
Sure, why not?
This is, I was in college. And so I remember that when Star Wars came out, we all looked at the ads and went, that looks really kind of weird. But then we started hearing good things about it. My family all went, but I was, you know, like at my Pizza Hut job or something because it was summertime. And they came back just raving about it. So my friends and I, as soon as school started, we all went to downtown Lawrence at KU and watched. And we just about fell out of our chairs. That was the most amazing movie we had ever seen. And we were all girls, but we didn't care. I think which speaks to the fact that it works for kids, it works for people of any sex, it works for people of any age practically till you get to a certain, you know, people who are too old right now. But I still remember how astounding that movie was. And I've been having conversations with another mutual friend of Scott's of mine, Joseph Suzenka, who's been saying, oh, I think you could see there were sequels. And I think, and I'm like, no, you don't understand. We couldn't believe this. We didn't know what to expect. Nobody
expected. Keep in mind, also, not just the grim science fiction films of that day and age, but the the mainstream films were things like The French Connection and Dirty Harry. They were all grim, and the West was losing the Cold War. We had lost confidence in our wealth and power. And the other blessings that God, with an abundant hand, showered on America. But here's the thing I think is so ironic and so funny. George Lucas, I don't think he's a science fiction guy. I think he's a movie guy. I think he looked back at the movies he loved when he was a kid and looked at Buck Rogers and Flash Gordon and the other serials, the other adventure chapter plays, and he was trying to capture that mood, that feeling. Well, that mood and that feeling came from 1940s America when there was polio, and there was the Dust Bowl, and there was World War II. Three of the four Riders of the Apocalypse were at large in the world. But the movies were really optimistic, back in the 40s, at least for the serials. Well, he did capture that, and I think he unwittingly struck a nerve. I think he struck the nerve of the essentially conservative values of 1940s America, the can-do attitude, the Yankee attitude. Because even though there was a princess and a space pirate and a farm boy, I think the main characters in Star Wars were Americans. You know, the American girl who the pioneer girl who pulls out a gun and shoots an Indian, the hot rod kid who's tinkering with his ship that is his hot rod that's fascinating, the hot rod that he made in the garage, his jalopy, you know, and the farm boy is a farm boy. The farm boy's from Kansas. It looks like the desert of Tunisia, but it's really Kansas. It's where
you reminded me there of American Graffiti.
Right.
Which also had Harrison Ford in there, right? And also done by George Lucas, right?
Right, right.
Yeah, another movie that we didn't really see anything exactly like that until, you know, Lucas did it.
Yeah, you're right.
It also wasn't Grimm, American Graffiti, if I recall correctly.
No, you're right.
Mm-mm. It was a slice of life.
Yes, it was.
But it was a nostalgic slice of life that worked.
Yep.
Yeah, and that's what Star Wars seems to have, right? You know, like you said, it's futuristic and nostalgic at the same time. It does strum some kind of a string that's in all of us, right?
Well, why do you think it opens with long, long ago? It opens with Once Upon a Time because it's a fairy tale.
Right.
But it also harkens, but when the words in the first, I was there in one of the first showings in my area, and when the words crawled up the screen, and at that time it didn't say, you know, episode 3 or whatever it was on the top, episode 4, it was just the words. Everyone in the audience recognized it immediately, even though I knew no one here was old enough to have seen Flash Gordon in the theaters back in 1939, for example. But we all knew what it was, because he touched something that was in the heart of the American shared consciousness, if you will.
Is it American shared consciousness? I agree with what you're saying about, you know, there's some American in this, but as far as the mythology goes, you don't feel like that's universal, that's specifically American?
No, not at all, because the chapter play, the Flash Gordon and Buck Rogers are quintessentially American characters. Science fiction is even though science fiction got started in England and France, let me back up and tell you an anecdote very briefly. One of my favorite science fiction authors is a guy named A.E. Van Vogt. He is almost unknown these days, though at the time when he wrote, he was one of the big three. It was him, Isaac Asimov, and Bob Heinlein. They were the guys who were the stable authors of John W. Campbell Jr.'s Astounding Stories, as it was called at the time. Later, its name was changed to Analog. Mm-hmm. When he went to go sell his stories in France, and in France they loved him, he asked why the names of his characters were not translated into French names. Why wasn't it Jeune rather than John, for example? Jean rather than John. And the French said, oh, we all know that science fiction is American. It's publisher. Because it's the idea that of better living through technology is an American idea. Even though the British started the Industrial Revolution, the idea that you can use a machine to solve your problem and improve your life, that's an American idea. The little tropes in Star Wars, like the word crawl at the beginning, is from 1940s Hollywood. That's an American thing. Mm-hmm. Now, obviously, the theme of good versus evil, of plucky rebels fighting an empire, has some universal application. But America is also the home of the only successful rebellion in history, where we ended up better off than we were before we rebelled. You know, I mean, because the French. If the French made the same movie, the Republic would destroy the evil empire and then start the Reign of Terror, and then Napoleon would take over using his Sith powers. It would not be a happy ending.
Well, and to that point of if it's American, and I don't know how much this goes to communist China
I should say some of it's American, but clearly the good versus evil theme and other themes, rescuing a princess, attacking an evil castle of darkness, people with magical powers, the sword fighting, and all the watered down Taoism is all from Japanese films. So don't get me wrong. I'm just saying.
No. But what I was going to say is that the Chinese, I don't know if you guys have heard, but they've been having terrible trouble trying to market The Force Awakens in China because they never really understood Star Wars. And they never really saw it there. And I can't remember, but Star Wars translates Chinese into some really nonsensical phrase that doesn't make any sense to them. And so they're all just going, Star Wars, what? And so when you said that, I was like, yes, it has those big themes, but it also has stuff that in the 70s especially, and then later, they never caught up on the Star Wars stuff, even though they love American movies and everything. So,
Well, I can only report my personal observations. I went to China to pick up my daughter about 4 years ago, and because of the communists don't recognize our copyright laws, you can get pirate copies of practically everything there.
Right.
which the Chai Coms just steal in the name of sharing all goods in common. And they have plenty of science fiction, I can tell you that. Mm-hmm. Now, they may not be Star Wars fans per se, but they certainly have plenty of science fiction. And the Japanese, too, by the way. I think the Japanese science fiction, some of it's better than American science fiction these days.
Oh, yeah.
I'm especially thinking of Miyazaki, who does both fantasy and science fiction movies.
Yes.
Absolutely amazing, life-changing movies. He's as, at least as good as Disney.
Oh yeah. Love him so much.
Yep.
Oh,
we are fans, yes. for sure.
But, and you know, one of the things, though, that I hear about George Lucas that people now looking back like to say, oh, he was such a broad storyteller, he made all these mistakes or all these holes, which, you know, technically may be true. Yeah, dialogue, not his best forte, but...
Nonsense. The dialogue in Star Wars came straight out of Flash Gordon, Buck Rogers.
Well, that's
unchanged.
Fine. But my point is different, so wait a minute.
I'll wait patiently.
But the thing, I'm saying these are other people's criticisms too. I never noticed it until people brought this up, and I go, oh, yeah, I guess maybe, but whatever.
I just saw this original movie. The plot hangs together really well.
Well, that's
thanks to get it better than the Star Wars 7, the remake.
Right. Well, let's not go crazy. But anyway, what I was going to say is about the first one is that I really love the swashbuckling, confident, optimistic storytelling. And you think about it, and you think about it being broad strokes, and it's good versus evil, and all this stuff. But there are other more subtle moments. And not including, you know, the little humorous asides that are wonderful. But what I'm thinking of are moments like when Luke, you know, he's the farm boy. He can't go off to university till next season because the crops haven't done well enough. And but he's still loyal to his aunt and uncle. He goes off and finds Obi-Wan, comes back. The evil stormtroopers have been there, and his aunt and uncle are skeletons. Mm-hmm. And... not only does that give him we know how awful everybody is then because there's no reason to kill him. He now has revenge on his mind also. But what it does in the storytelling, which is a much subtler point that had to be pointed out to me later by my daughter Rose, is he's now free to leave.
Yep.
All ties have been cut. And that's just a little storytelling free thing. He doesn't have to worry about going back. He doesn't have to worry about his obligation. He doesn't have to fill in get somebody to fill in on the farm. He can take the droids and go. And those are things you don't expect.
I, of course, notice them because I'm a professional author, because we call it the Disney effect. What you do is you make sure that the mom is absent, because otherwise the main character is not going to go on any adventure. The father either has to be an incompetent fool or has to be absent. Otherwise, the main character would stay at home and the parents would take care of the problem. And you'd have no adventure. You'd have no story at all. But
right.
Yes,
to establish who he was,
I noticed the elegance of that. The people who poo-poo it are, of course, pooftas. They're overly self-absorbed artistes. To write an Edgar Rice Burroughs story or an adventure story or an Errol Flynn-type story is actually quite difficult and requires a certain rather limited skill set that you have to hone to get your things right, to get all the elements correct. Because the pacing considerations make it very difficult to establish character quickly, and you have to rely on stereotypes to get those hooks in as quickly as possible. And if you look at the original Star Wars, you can see how rapidly it was done. Darth Vader steps into a room and has no lines. He merely stands there and breathes, and you know he's the bad guy. He's dressed in a black cloak, and he's wearing a Nazi helmet, and his face is a skull.
I can attest to that. When my son was two, I brought him to a re-release of Star Wars back when they did that. Mm-hmm. And the moment Darth Vader walked out, he said, uh-oh. I mean, I remembered it was really loud. Everybody was
silent.
And it was a
moment like a 1940s serial where you boo when the villain comes on the stage.
Yeah.
And the two comedy relief droids, a tall, thin guy and a short, fat guy, Mutt and Jeff, the characters established immediately. The first line is the fussy English butler dressed in gold complaining that he's going to, oh no, we're going to be destroyed for sure now. There's no escape for the princess. Established a character instantly, automatically a likable character because he's worried about his friend and he's a coward and it's just adorable, okay? Mm-hmm. And so on for all the characters. Han Solo is introduced immediately when it's not the first thing he does, but when Guido the bounty hunter sits down next to him, he, being a tough and lovable rogue, draws his pistol and shoots the guy into the table, killing him instantly. Okay, and then he waves at the bartender and throws him a tip to pay for the expense of hauling the body away. Okay, what else do you need to know about that character? That's perfect. Okay, it's perfect. The Princess Leia, her first line is, "I smelled your stench when I first came aboard." Okay, what else do you need to know about her? You see what I'm saying? It's actually a skill set as a droid as painting a miniature. Or as snapping a black and white photographs and capturing someone's personality just at the right time, just with the right lines, just with the right camera angles. So I dismiss anyone who dismisses Star Wars as being too broad or too simplistic. But it would not be so popular if it was not a work of art.
So as a storyteller, what does that depend on in the viewer? What are you assuming as a writer that the viewer has seen before or has experienced before, so that those things just work like that?
Writers think of it in terms of how wide or narrow the audience is. You have certain things in common only with your family, such as in-jokes that no one outside your family is not going to get. You have things in common with your fellow Virginians that Yankees are not going to understand, if you guys are from Virginia, if you're not. You have things in common with other Americans that foreigners are either not going to get, or they're only going to get it kind of indirectly. Then you have things that are in common with all mankind. And a good storyteller tries to tap into all those levels at once, but the stories that last from generation to generation are the ones, of course, that have the broadest appeal. Now, to make a broad appeal, you do have to have some things that are somewhat stereotyped or simplistic, at least at first. But now, here's where the genius comes in, here's where the trick comes in. If the muse comes and visits you and shows you a connection between something everyone knows, such as, let's say you're Shakespeare and you're writing Hamlet, and everyone knows what an indecisive man is like, but few people know how to draw the connection between how an indecisive man acts and how an indecisive man would act in a revenge play. Or once again, if you're Shakespeare and you're writing Othello, everyone knows what a jealous man is, but very few people can say, what would a jealous man act like if he was in the middle of a tragedy? So what Shakespeare did is, if he had put Othello in the Hamlet story, the story would have lasted one act because Othello would have killed Claudio and that would have been it. Okay? And if he had put Hamlet in Othello's situation, as soon as Iago says, "Oh, your wife is cheating on you," he would have gone, "Well, maybe yes, maybe no. I should check this out first, see?" So the difference between a guy who is just telling a stereotyped story using stock characters in a boring fashion and a genius is not that one guy uses stereotypes and the other guy doesn't. Both guys use stereotypes. The difference is that the genius is shown something deeper about how that character would act in various situations. So that even when you see something you've never seen before, like the indecisive Avenger, you know, think about it. Hamlet's the indecisive Avenger. You know, it's like, imagine Batman going, "Well, I should get around someday to killing criminals." You know, it's actually an amusing concept. Mm-hmm. You still don't lose the universal appeal with that. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. That's fascinating. Yeah.
If you're writing for a more limited audience, you have to rely upon the more general audience understanding at least what the limited audience understands. I don't think Tolkien was writing only for his co-religionists, but there's something so universal in what he writes that it, like Star Wars, had a huge appeal because he tapped into something really fundamental in the human psyche. And when people dismiss it as good versus evil, well, those kind of people are, of course, evil, and they've never written anything worth reading or remembering.
Well, they've never seen a good picture of it, so they're not sure what to recognize sometimes because they've been confused before, I think.
They've been told that novelty, they've been told that good equals new and new equals getting away from good and evil. And so they think it's new and daring to preach free love or something else that's a new and daring idea like Gnosticism, a first century heresy, or communal living. That's a new idea from the Stone Ages. Or what are their other new ideas? Their new ideas are really old if you think about it.
I'm continually surprised at how often I'll be reading something and I'll go, "Oh, Tom, you know that new thing that everybody thinks right now? Here's something from third century. It's exactly this."
No, I love it.
You know?
Yeah.
Scott, you were saying. Sorry.
Yeah, no, I was just saying, you know, Lewis and Tolkien are famous for talking about myth, you know, and Lewis mm-hmm. converting partially because Tolkien convinced him that, well, Christianity is the myth that's true. So do you use the word myth to convey what we all have in the most broadest sense in common?
I would say this. I would say that when the devil rather cleverly invented how the human gift of speech, which we were given above all animals, could be turned to bad ends by saying things that were not true, that God then turned the gift of lies into myths so that we could say we could make untrue statements that told a deeper truth than you could put into words. So I think that's a genius way of putting that. I had never thought about that before. I'm sure if you look, you'll find Tolkien or Lewis said something of this something of the kind. I'm sure the idea is not original to me.
Well, you're the first person I've heard say it, so you get the genius for a minute.
Yes. Well, I'm old-fashioned. I believe genius is something that visits you, not something you have. I never would say I'm a genius. I would say some of my works occasionally were visited by genius, by which I mean a muse from heaven, an angel from heaven came and inspired something I did.
Right.
Not, so,
yeah.
But my point about myth is that there are things in the human background, in the human mind, in the human psyche, like the deposit of faith of the Catholic Church, there's a deposit of stories that is the fundamental way we understand the world. Now, we Christians know something that the pagans don't know, which is that the world is a story. The faithful Buddhist believes it's just a wheel, never beginning and never ending. Mm-hmm. And the Norseman thinks it's tragedy, ending in the twilight of the gods.
Right.
But the Christians think it is a melodrama where you have a fall at the beginning, problem set up in chapter one, a surprise twist, a plot twist in the middle, where the author steps into his own book and dies mm-hmm. a horrible, shameful, humiliating, a slave's death, and then a eucatastrophe, what Tolkien, I believe, coined that term, of a surprise happy ending where he comes back with the promise of a sequel, and then the future that we are promised is things are going to get worse and then terrible and then horrific and then we win. And then it's a happy ending, okay?
Yeah.
So in terms of drama, that's the structure. The structure of all human drama is set up in those five acts, like I've just said. So any story like Professor Tolkien's Lord of the Rings that taps into the one real story of which life itself is made is going to be a lot more popular than something, let's say, if I can use the example of Life of Manuel, by an author you've never heard of, because he also wrote Jurgen. I can't even remember his name. When Tolkien's book first came out, it was reviewed by some snooty, pompous, outrageously self-important New York editor who was extremely influential at the time. And I can't remember his name only because I despise him. And he wrote his article is called "Ooh, Ooh, Those Awful Orcs," where he dismissed Tolkien's work as being inferior to that of the other guy whose name I can't remember. I could look up on the internet if I wasn't talking to myself. Mm-hmm. But that guy's almost entirely forgotten because he could not tap into the one true story of which all stories are reflections. What many of my pagan and atheist friends don't seem to understand is we Christians are not enemies of paganism. We're the culmination of it. The reason why the Muslims blow up the Afghan statues of Buddha, and that the Christians form the science of anthropology to go study them, is we see little scattered bits of the light even in other people's mythologies, because we don't think they're necessarily false. We just think they're incomplete. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. It does.
So whenever someone says, "Oh, the Christmas tree is a pagan holdover from a first-century tree-worshipping religion," A, that's completely bogus because the Christmas tree was invented in the 1850s in Germany, and B, even if it were true, then more glory to us because that means we have baptized and saved a perfectly lovely pagan custom, the same way we saved Cupid by putting him on our St. Valentine's Day cards. St. Valentine is a saint.
Right. Well, and the point you made about, you know, the world is a story, I just recently read a book called The Storytelling Animal, which is a nonfiction book, a guy who, it
the first few chapters are definitely worth reading. And his big flaw really was that he kept bringing everything back to, but evolution should be able to, we can't see how evolution did this and how evolution did this. And at one point he says, and I'm like, well, why do you have to always bring it to this? This is obviously you can't see past this focus, right? And so he at one point says, it's interesting that we evolved with this deep knowledge of story, because story is how we understand everything and tell everything, including when we sit down to dinner and say, what was our day? We tell a story. We tell a story about going to the grocery store. We do all this. He goes, it's funny how we evolved to do that, and there's no real reason for it, but there must be a reason for it. Because what? And I'm like, wow, you're going in this huge circle, and I could solve that for you, but you're not going to listen to me.
I wish I know the answer. I wish that such people who consider themselves to be intellectual would learn the basics of the scientific method. Because if your theory A is circular, then it's neither provable nor disprovable. So it doesn't follow the Karl Popper rule that unless your theory can be disproven, it's not a theory. And yep. B, if you're a scientist, you have to show me the evidence of showing me that the Neanderthal did not tell stories, and therefore this prevented them from reproducing in sufficient numbers to compete against the early Homo sapiens. You have to show the link between this alleged behavior that you say came out of nowhere and reproductive power. And you also have to show me why you guys are not all Catholic, because if reproductive power is the sole measure of Darwinian supremacy, then we don't use contraceptives and we don't allow for divorce and we raise our kids and you guys don't. So,
yeah.
And all this talk about story makes me think of something that between The Force Awakens, the newest movie, which, by the way, everybody. Huge spoilers coming. Yeah. So if you've seen it, otherwise go in, watch it. But
yeah, I always warn people about the spoilers. That's important. And I am glad it's the only time Americans have always cooperated is keeping the spoilers down for Force Awakens.
That was impressive, wasn't it?
It is. It and by the way, so Rosebud is a sled.
Fine.
Well, the psychiatrist is a ghost. He's dead.
Well, anyway.
I'm assuming everyone already knows those two. Sorry. I'll stop.
All right, fine. Spoilers for The Force Awakens. But the thing is one of the things that I've seen people talking about, either pro or con, is the parallels between the newest Star Wars movie and the first Star Wars movie. I myself really enjoyed most of them because Scott and I were talking before, but one of the things is that I feel like they're going, we're not rebooting it, guys, but we're showing you this Star Wars is going to be like the Star Wars you loved, not like those last three movies, so you can feel safe. But the other thing I really, really liked, and it made me actually think of your story, One Bright Star to Guide Them. Is that the right title? Okay.
That's right. It's my favorite story.
Which I love. Everybody should read it. Because that story talks about kids who've had a Narnia-type experience and when they're older, what happens? What are they like then? If something new comes up from that world again, how do they all react because now they're grown-ups? And so looking at the way they used these parallels to draw us in and remind us of the world that we already loved, but yet also started opening up and showing us new things, that resonated for me in a way that I can only liken for any Christians listening to an Old Testament, New Testament vibe. In that the Old Testament tells us what's going to happen in the New Testament, but the New Testament, when we read it, also informs our reading of the Old Testament. So it's like having a piece of light between two mirrors that you see more and more and more the more you look at it. And one thing, which is what made me think of your story, was Leia and Han and the story of their family. And how when they meet up, and this is something that my daughter really hated, this whole, exposition part. But I'm like, I loved it because it, to me, looked very real. It was like two very uncomfortable people who still were fond of each other but had suffered divorce or separation or whatever.
And so I looked at that and I suddenly, it filled in a lot for me story-wise. And so then when Han went on and he's facing Kylo Ren and we're all going, holy crap, we know what's coming. But because I felt I love Han Solo in a way I couldn't love Obi-Wan. I mean, I loved him, but not the way I love Han Solo. And I knew what was coming and it happened. And I suddenly flashed back and felt Luke's pain much more because I looked at that with new eyes. You know, and then later when Kylo Ren was fighting with Rey, I, both knowing Darth Vader's story and knowing that I had seen this indecision in him, which we were shown, I was both wanting her to beat him, but not wanting her to kill him. Because I was like, well, logically, surely they can't kill him because the movie's going to go on into a sequel. But I want him to have the chance to turn to the light, to be good, for redemption. And so I was fascinated by these parallel strands that were being used. And some of this is me, I get it. But for me, it just made both works deeper and richer. And I really liked that a lot.
One thing that I learned as an author, though I knew it even as a writer before I became an author, is that the story is only the seed. The story is only half of the conception. The viewer, the reader, his imagination provides the soil.
Yeah.
And what grows up is half the writers, but also as half the viewers. That's why, to some degree, it's almost impossible to talk about movies you really love or books you really love, because if I'm infatuated with a girl, I overlook all her flaws because I'm in love with her. if I hate someone, I overlook all his good points because I hate him. Okay, in both cases, I'm either blind because of Cupid or blind because of Demogorgon, and so in a movie where you decide to fall in love with it, it becomes your favorite movie. And the decision is not necessarily a conscious decision. It's half and half. It's like falling in love. You kind of decide, but you kind of are swept away. Now, as a writer, I of course can see both what it looks like when you're sitting in the audience when the magician does the trick, and what it looks like from behind the scenes where you can see the stage machinery and you see where the mirrors are. Because I've put up mirrors like that myself. So you understand the difference I'm saying? Mm-hmm. If you're sitting in the audience, you get pulled into the magician hypnotizes you. He pulls you into the trick. He pulls you into the story. And what we as readers and viewers want to see is we want to be pulled into a story that's bigger than real life. Because secretly deep down, we know real life is not the whole story. That's why humans tell stories. Because we know that this world is not the way it is. When we land on Mars, we find out that the Martians were actually evolved and not created, they will have nothing but newspapers and they will talk about nothing but business. Because they won't have, right? They won't have any stories to them. Their world will be the only world they know. They won't know that they won't feel homesick for heaven. They won't know that there's a bigger world out there that we want to see a glimpse of. Well, Star Wars showed, the original Star Wars showed a glimpse of that bigger world very, very cleanly and nicely by playing on the nostalgic love of past movies, by playing on fairy tales, by playing on the exotic love of Oriental martial arts movies, because there's some elements of that in there with the sword fighting and such, and the Force, and by playing on our love of the future, the American love of the of tomorrow, Tomorrowland, like a Disney ride. And anytime that someone does that, any movie that's capable of doing that has the magic, has the power that stories have. Mm-hmm. So to a degree, talking about anything where, you know, I can see where the mirrors are, I can see where the wires are, that diminishes from the magic is against the point. Is actually slightly rude. On the other hand, I've never seen any movie in my life where I had so much of a divided reaction. As a fan, I loved the movie to pieces, and I can't explain it. And as a writer, I thought it was an insult. It was atrocious, not just bad, but actually a slap in the face. And I can't reconcile those two opposite reactions. I felt the same way. I felt both of those reactions, and for entirely different reasons and for entirely different elements. When the Star Destroyer occludes the moon and is a dark shadow of oppression, and you see the officers of the First Order descending in their horrible black square assault vehicles, That's magic. You're in the movie, okay? You're in the world. Star Wars has come to life again, which is what all the fans were wanting. That's what we wanted, okay? We wanted Star Wars again, right?
Yeah.
Anytime you make a meal, of course, if they liked your last meal, they both want something new and they want the same thing. Every time you make a sequel, either in a book or a movie, you're always caught in this between the Scylla and Charybdis of you got to do something new and it's got to be the same as before. There's two ways out of this problem. One is to mess it up royally so that you neither give them what they want nor give them something new. And the other way is to look at what you've already established and draw out a logical deduction, draw out an implication that was hidden there but that the reader may not have seen before. Now, in this, Empire Strikes Back is actually my favorite movie of the original trilogy because they brought in what is her name? World Reckle Hamilton's wife, Leigh Brackett.
Leigh Brackett, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Leigh Brackett, who also wrote the Bogart movie. She wrote The Big Sleep. She's one of my guys. She's a science fiction guy.
Sure. Yeah.
And she's from the old days. She's from before, she's from the pulp era. She's from even before John W. Campbell Jr. She wrote, was it Northwest Smith or was it, excuse me, the guy born on Mercury, I can't remember his name. Eric John Stark. She wrote the Eric John Stark pulp fiction. Okay. Oh, and by the way, if anyone tells you that science fiction writers used to keep women out of science fiction, just say the name Leigh Brackett and then stab them in the gut with a shovel, then dig a grave with a shovel and bury them because they're fools and they're using up precious oxygen. No, I'm not advocating murder. I just think such people say things without regard to real history. Mm-hmm. They don't bother finding out what's in the genre. Right. In any case. Mm-hmm. She and Lawrence Kasdan did exactly what I'm talking about. They took the themes and the ideas in the first movie and they made it slightly deeper, slightly darker. And it was the first movie that was not just blowing up the Death Star again. I was kind of disappointed in the third, quite frankly, because they repeated the theme that they had in the first one. But be that as it may, I think the movie successfully recaptured the Star Wars magic in a way that the prequels, the Jar Jar prequels, did not recapture it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. The first three movies don't I can't think of any memorable character from them. The Star Wars movie I can go, the lovable rogue, the space farm boy, the princess in distress, the black knight, the wizard. You know, and you guys all know who I'm talking about.
Oh yeah,
you guys know which characters I mean, right?
Oh sure.
But Jeff, the comedy relief robots, the Tin Man. You see?
Yeah.
The lovable, fierce, gigantic dog who helps fly the spaceship. Okay.
Yeah, and it's funny because in those first three, there is an emperor, but he's non-consequential. I mean, you know, he's just the evilest power.
Well, what happened in the first three to me is there's a scene where I think it was Ben Kenobi was flying through an asteroid field to try to land on some planet, and they used the same special effect that they used in the asteroid scene in the second movie, which it was so dramatic, where the...
Millennium
Falcon is trying to hide from the oncoming Super Star Destroyers, and there was absolutely no tension because young Obi-Wan Kenobi had no chance of failure because he was a Jedi, see the future.
He was going to be in the future, yeah.
And so I thought at that moment I realized that I was not going to enjoy any of the first three movies because the writer there did not know how to set up the storyline of how to do a tragedy to show the decline and fall of the Roman Empire in space. He didn't know what he was doing because he doesn't know what causes evil, and so he didn't portray it correctly. He should have hired a Catholic to do it. We're guilt-ridden. We're all about evil.
That's the trouble with prequels.
And it would have been simple. All he had to do was return for the first three movies. All he had to do was return to his chapter play roots and have the Jedi Council knows there's a traitor among them. They don't know which one of them it is. They meet. They discuss their plans. They go off. One guy turns away, puts on a Darth Vader helmet, and goes and kills one of the other guys. Because when you did Flash Gordon movies, that was the formula you used. You just did the formula of there's a group of people. They know that there's something up, and they go. And somehow he always knows their plans. And whenever the good guys go somewhere to stop the plan, the bad guy has a thug jump him, and they have a fight scene. How hard is that to do?
I want to see those prequels. Yeah.
Well, let me spoil one other thing for you then.
Yeah.
A friend of mine named Daddy Warpig, not his real name, suggested that he would have enjoyed the seventh movie much better if they had not taken away Han Solo's character development from the second and third movie. Because he was no longer the lovable rogue. He had turned into a hero. He had turned into a general in the Resistance. Mm-hmm. Leia also should have shown... For him to go back to merely being a smuggler, and if the critters he was transporting were intelligent than a slaver, for him to go back to being a smuggler was a bit of a disappointment. Here's what he suggested, and I thought this was a brilliant idea. He said, why didn't they switch the roles of Leia and Han? Han is now the overworked ex-pirate who is now a military officer and a leader who has to worry about income tax and his military up to snuff and intelligence reports and fighting the First Order. And Leia, who did a perfectly fine job sneaking into Jabba the Hutt's disguised as a bounty hunter, actually has become a bounty hunter and is scouring the spaceways looking for her missing family member.
Interesting.
That
would have worked. Yeah. Now that would have, I thought, had a twist that this one didn't really have. I thought this was like a remake to me. It wasn't even a sequel. Now don't get me wrong. I love the scenes when the Death Star number 3 shoots a beam of energy across interstellar space and blows up a dozen planets. I thought that was absolutely wonderful. It looked like a scene that I might have written. But it wasn't like Empire Strikes Back. They didn't draw me to the next step of where they were going to go. It really did look like a remake to me, and it really did look like it was not as well thought out. There's plot twists in the original Star Wars, such as when, after an exciting space dogfight scene, the Millennium Falcon gets away. Princess Leia shakes her head at Han Solo and says, "We were allowed to escape. This is a trick." Yeah. And he goes, "Nah, sister, not this ship." And, of course, then you cut back to Darth Vader talking with Grand Moff Tarkin, and he says, "They were allowed to escape," you know, because actually it would be very difficult to... Can you imagine taking off from an aircraft carrier, a modern aircraft carrier, with a jet that you stole? It would be really difficult. There was nothing like that in the sequel, the one that came out. There's no plot twists that I found convincing or surprising.
Yeah. Well, that may be true, but it feels like everything's wide open now. It's like... Yeah. We got this first one done.
Yeah.
You know, there's something that you, Julie, you know, suggested that I read One Bright Star to guide them before this podcast, and I dutifully did, and I'm very happy I did because it was excellent.
Thank you.
But there was something really poignant in there. There was a character that said, "Hey, we were done. You know, we finished this a long time ago." You know, to me, you know, you look at Return of the Jedi, you know, where the group shot at the end, you know, everybody snapped the photos, very happy, you know, and it's like, okay, they lived happily ever after is what that said, you know. And then, but your character in One Bright Star to Guide Them, he said, well, the story never ends. I've learned it merely changes to another and another, and it goes on and on. Which was very poignant and stirred a lot of thought in me about Star Wars.
That makes me happy because I am a thief, and that line is stolen almost unchanged from, I forget if it was from Tolkien or if it was from Lewis, but it was really? From one of them.
Excellent.
I think it's from Tolkien. There's a scene where Sam Gamgee is talking with Frodo. They're on the slopes of Mordor, Dark Land, and they're talking about the story that they're going to be in.
That's right.
And they suddenly realize that they're tied in with the ancient past of things that to them were myths, and it's still coming true. It's Tolkien's idea that there's true myth in the world in the shape of the Catholic Church.
Yeah.
The three of us as Catholics know that we're part of the same story that's in the Gospel of Luke when the star appears above Bethlehem. Excuse me. Yeah. I think the star is in a different gospel, but be that as it may.
It's all for one thing.
Yeah. So I think that what J.J. Abrams has done here is he gave us the Star Wars that we wanted.
I agree.
And now it is wide open. I certainly hope that the second movie does not mirror Empire Strikes Back.
Turns to something new.
Yeah.
But here's the thing I noticed about this movie and what I disliked about it and disliked intensely. Almost all the discussions I've had since have been with fans inventing things that were simply not in the movie to explain what was really going on. And if any of those things had actually been in the movie, it would have been a better movie. It would have been quite a good movie, in fact. But it was all stuff that they were just making up out of whole cloth, for example.
It's to
explain little things, little plot holes, like how does the TIE fighter get away from a fully operational, Star Destroyer at the very beginning? A scene I rather like, by the way. I did like the interaction of the two characters right at the beginning. And I thought it was brilliant. I thought that the Stormtrooper character was brilliant. The idea that someone might have second thoughts about his choice of profession when he was not given a choice at all. That a character I really liked. But
yeah, because we never think about them because they're just sword fodder generally. You know, they're the faceless evil, and the fact that they're actually orcs. Humans.
Yeah. Orcs, right. Yep.
Mm-hmm. And like Tolkien, he has some orcs come on stage and you hear them talk and they're not so faceless after that. Now, I really like that scene. But then it went downhill for me rather quickly because the girl living on the junkyard world, which, by the way, I thought was visually very impressive. I loved the huge wrecked spaceships. That was great, visually great. Mm-hmm. I can't remember a single line she says that's witty or memorable, even though I could quote almost all Star Wars to you. From start to finish, it was all witty. I can't recall any real affection between those two characters, except for briefly once. And I wish that the scene had either gone on longer or been returned to, where they managed to shoot Pursuit out of the sky. Even though it wasn't clear why she was such a good pilot. I wasn't clear why. Where did she get her training from? I mean, that wasn't at least Luke, has hunted Womp Rats in Beggar's Canyon back home.
Mm-hmm.
That she also can sword fight with a wounded Sith. That's I've sword fought when I was in college, and I once handed my roommate, who was a younger, stronger, and faster guy than I, my foil, and I put on my mask and held up a broomstick, and I put my back to the wall so I couldn't even back up, and I said, "You cannot hit me with a sword. You cannot touch me." And it was true. I could simply parry him no matter what he did because he didn't have the reflexes for it.
Mm-hmm.
So in the last fight scene, unless they establish a reason why Kylo Ren, Darth Jr., is trying not to hurt her, the scene made no sense to me. And that wasn't the only thing she did where she wasn't a three-dimensional character to me. She could do everything better. She could rewire she could fix the Millennium Falcon better than Han Solo himself. I mean, that's almost insulting.
But I felt like because of her junk experience, she was continually bringing in pieces of stuff and having to mess around with them to fix them. To me, that worked because she was on that junk world. That was, to me, in the realm of possibility.
If that had been the only thing where she was better than all the other characters, I would give you that one.
I played Edge of the Empire. As Finn could fight on the Millennium Falcon, she was not a great space pilot. She was running into stuff. She was not managing things. She was doing it by the skin of her teeth, the same as Finn was, you know.
But once again, as a writer, I wish they would have established that the reason why she could outfly the pursuit was because she was familiar with the junk piles they were flying through.
Yeah.
That would have been a perfectly fine fan save for me.
Mm-hmm. That's fine. I never knew why Princess Leia was super good at bossing people around and having all her plans work. It just did it for me, you know. There she was. Know her backstory. So.
And I thought about that after, but is my thought that she's kind of a prodigy of the Force, and she kind of intuitively knows some things, and I realize, you know, when she told.
Well, then establish that in the plot. Then have someone say,
so have someone say
how
it.
Unusual it is that this woman has all this strange aura of strength about her that we don't understand. I mean, mm-hmm. This is the first time I ever handed her a gun, and she's a crack shot by the next scene. That's amazing.
Mm-hmm.
See?
I loved her, though. Because I told Julie, you know, at the end, you know, she takes Han Solo's seat. You know, she's got Han Solo's chair. She's a Jedi. You know, she's everything, but I loved her. I thought she was fantastic.
Yeah, she gets to be
both Han Solo and Luke. The farm boy at the same time.
Zaya. She can do all.
Yeah.
I know. Blasphemy, but I'm just saying.
But Armistice was humble, you know. Mm-hmm. Here's the problem. Here's the problem as a writer. If you have, whenever you're doing an ensemble piece, and I've done several where you have more than one character, where you have at least three or five characters, each one of them has to have his day in the sun. Each one of them has to have at least one scene where they do one thing that no one else does correctly. Even in the movie The Untouchables, they had to have the accountant be the guy who captures the bad guy, yeah, because he's the one who figured out his income tax records. You know, it's okay to have the accountant also have a shotgun and blow someone away. That's fine. But if you have one character who does everything correct, let's say it's Superman, and then the rest of the Justice League, Wonder Woman and Batman and Green Lantern, don't get to do anything. He's better at all of what they do than they are. Then you don't have a Justice League. You don't have an ensemble piece. Mm-hmm. The movie's just about her. And she was not a strong enough or complicated enough character to carry the whole movie.
I felt like it was about her and Finn, to me.
It might have been if they hadn't had Finn undergo the obligatory desire to escape. I thought they did a brilliant job when they had Finn pretending to be a member of the Resistance and having to fake it. That I thought was great, okay? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But they didn't capitalize on that. There should have been a second hook. There should have been a second twist that came out of that.
Well, she also wanted to run away, though, at one point. I mean, they each had their moments where this I thought was interesting, too, is they each had their moments where they went, oh, no, let's run. I'm running, or come with me, I'm running away. But circumstances forced them, in both cases, back into spots where, because of who they were, they couldn't turn their back on an action they needed to take.
Well, like I said, with half my soul, I love this movie, but with half my soul, I despise it.
I know,
The part that despised it, I have to say, I have to turn your words against you and say, do you remember when Luke Skywalker's parents, foster parents, died in the first movie? That was the moment of no return. It was clear. It was short. They had just showed the robots burning the corpses in the background. All he said one line. He said, there's nothing for me here now, or some line as brief as that. But in this movie, what was the hook that forced them into the action? What was the point of no return? Because when you're writing a story, there always has to be in every scene is supposed to have the opposite emotional mood at the end of the scene as at the beginning of the scene. Otherwise, leave the scene out. Every scene is supposed to have some development or some sliding backward or something that changes 180 degrees. And at the moment when there's no return, at the moment when you jump off the cliff without a parachute and you say, I am now devoted to the rebellion, or you say, I am now going to throw the ring in the volcano, or you say whatever it is, where there's no turning back, that's the moment. And you pointed out what that moment was in the first movie, but I don't see what that moment was
That's not where I was going with that point. But what were you going to say, Scott?
I was
going to
say, didn't they both, decided. For Finn, he was on his way out until the place was attacked, and then he decided he couldn't leave. But it was a decision. And then she was running away, and then she saw the place about to be attacked. And then she chose to turn around and run back to the place. So I felt like, you know, that moment was a decision they made. It wasn't a decision they had to make, but they made it.
But again, compared to the first movie where the first thing Luke says about the rebellion, you're in the rebellion to fight the Empire? He's excited about the idea.
Sure. Yeah.
And he's the rather simple plot conflict of him wanting to stay with his family and complete his schooling and complete his farm work. Even Obi-Wan says, that's your uncle talking.
Hmm. Yeah, but these are also, they're very different characters, too. I mean, they've both...
I'm not talking about the character. I'm talking about how the simplicity and the elegance of the writing. Where that character, with four or five lines, you showed the entire plot conflict, the entire character growth, and the point of no return.
Actually, for me, with Rey, it didn't even have to be that. For me, it was when she was sitting there eating and licking the plate. And I saw how little she got for all her hard work. And that she was totally alone, and she was so hungry she was licking her plate. And after that, I understood everything she was doing. And with the vision of her as a small child going, come back, those two things were what I needed. Now, I knew her then.
I thought that was good setup, but I thought there was no follow-through. When the camera pans back and you see all the marks, and you see all the marks she's made on the wall, as to how long she's been in what's basically a prison. That was excellent. That was extremely well done. Then when you see her memory of being abandoned, excellent and extremely well done. And then you need the hook. Then you need the next twist. Then you need the next step. Then you need the point of no return, where she says, I cannot wait any longer for those people. I break my ties with them. And it has to be shown in a movie, not just said. Mm-hmm. But there was no sharp break.
Okay, well, the place I was going to go before with all this was, although that was really, I liked to hear it. It was great. And but what I was thinking, too, was something that will probably start us on to a longer conversation, too, is I thought it was really interesting how circumstances kept turning Finn and Rey around, right? They keep being put back in the situation. Now, of course, it's because it's a movie. But in this circumstance, they keep getting into spots where they have to choose. They have to choose. They have to choose, just as we all do in real life.
Yeah, that was good.
But what was really interesting was a conversation I was having with my daughter again, which was, she said, you know what's interesting is all the circumstances in this, nobody ever stops and says, is this the Force? Or is this me? And I said, oh, because the Force is an animistic kind of, it's just a life force thing that you can tap into, or it helps you find who you are. You center yourself using it or something, is my understanding. I'm like, and to for the Force to actually be putting them in those circumstances, it would have to be alive and intelligent and a person and have a will and a plan. It would have to be God. And that's the only way that ever works. So that's why they don't ever have those thoughts in it. And I had never thought about the fact that you could interpret the Force doing that in the movies, but it's never brought up.
Which, if I may, it would have to awaken.
Oh, yeah. Brilliant.
But you see, once again, that would have been a brilliant movie, but that's not the movie I saw.
Oh, no, no. That's
because if they had put if someone had said, the Force guides you and it partly controls your actions, but partly you control it, and yet something has disturbed the Force so greatly that it is now taking a more definite role, and you are the one. Do you see the difference between a scene like that and what we saw where the girl just never fails at anything she puts her hand to?
Oh, yeah.
I do, yeah.
She's both Luke Skywalker and Han Solo and the princess. That's too much.
But I was struck, too, by the fact that we know we won't see that in that movie because that's, for one thing, it's not about God, even though it's about it's called The Force Awakens because it's talking about the people. But it was interesting to me because the fact that it has the Force in it at all is, I feel, unusual. Of course, it's so they can do magic. But it's still recognizing a higher power of some sort, whatever that is. And that's really rare, too. And I think that's because it was started in 1977 when people didn't think about that so much. You know?
Also because in 1977, Kung Fu movies were cool.
Well, yeah.
They hadn't come to America yet.
Yeah.
In fact, I wrote an essay in Star Wars on Trial, which is just on that theme, as to what the religious and philosophical implications of the Force were. And my rather cynical opinion was, the Force is deliberately as vague and minimal as possible. In the first movie, it's only mentioned in about four lines, and everything you know about it is summed up in those four lines. And it's a science fiction version of Taoism that allows the main characters to do way cool, you know, mind powers and special effects. And in the second movie, you can telekinesis too. Just enough to make the fight scenes cool, but not enough to so that there's no fight scene. Because if you actually were psychokinetic, you'd simply walk up and stop the guy's heart without taking your hands out of your pocket.
Yeah.
So it's just enough garnish. It's just enough sugaring on the lasagna to give it some flavor. Maybe that's not the best metaphor, but it's not going to intrude and actually be something trying to preach a philosophy. When in the one of the things problems with the prequels that I didn't like is they actually had Yoda say too much about the Force, and he said, you know, hate leads to malevolence, and malevolence leads to beer drinking, and beer drinking leads to and he basically said a Buddhist style moral code where disengagement was the morally correct behavior in that code, and according to that code, young, whiny Darth Vader should have left his wife, his gorgeous wife. And I just thought, this is terrible on every level. They should have kept it vague. They should have kept it like an action film. It's supposed to have just a little bit of, you know, mystical flavor to it to give it a little bit of seasoning. But otherwise, the first three movies did it perfectly. By the first three movies, I mean the second three movies. And the second three movies, by which I mean the first three movies, did it horribly. This movie, I think, did it correctly. In fact, if anything, I wish there had been a little more of the Force in this movie so that some of the things that otherwise seemed inexplicable would have been, people would have gone, that's the Force. Or people would have gone, something mysterious is happening or destiny is stirring. You see what I'm saying? Mm. I would have liked that more. Now, keep in mind, most of my objections, if in the sequel they explain some of the things that are left unexplained, then most of my objections will go away. But not my objections which relate to the mechanics of the writing, where I'm still deeply offended. But once again, I must insist, I still loved the film, and I'm still going to go to the sequel. I'll just email Disney my credit card, because they make every film they make after is set in this universe. Let me ask a quick change of subject. Did you guys see the cartoon version, the computerized animated cartoon called Star Wars Rebels? Because what Disney did with that is they took the character of Aladdin from the Aladdin movie, they stuck him into the Star Wars universe, they put together an ensemble piece of comical and interesting characters, and they just are telling a very basic, very simple story about the last remaining two Jedi who are on the run, who are trying to find out who the forces are that are opposing the Empire. Have you ever seen this cartoon?
I've seen a couple episodes, yeah.
I thought that the storytelling in that was perfect.
Yeah.
I thought that Disney actually knows how to tell a story. And even after so many years in the business, they still haven't lost the ability, except when they made John Carter of Mars.
I loved John Carter of Mars. So see, here's some of our basic problem. We're going to argue about things like that anyway.
Did you ever read the book?
I could never get into the book. I've tried four times. So see, there's part of
because,
my problem. Disconnect
because
you, source material.
You, girl, me, boy. Book is the most boyish boys book I've ever seen, and the movie was not boyish. The movie was not.
I don't know. I liked most of the Tarzan books.
Well, in that case, you don't know it.
Tons of science fiction, but I just, that's why I kept trying, and I thought maybe I should try one later in, but I realize I'm totally disconnected from the source material, so I just came at it totally fresh, and I liked it.
That's the way to see a movie. There's a friend of mine who saw the Shadow when they made it into a movie, which I am a big fan of the Shadow, and I've read Walter Gibson's books and read the original pulps and stuff, and heard the radio plays, and so every deviation they made from the canon, I just thought was horrible. But a friend of mine who had never even heard of the character before, he's a radio play character, okay? That's how old he is, this guy. And Batman is based on him, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
That's my theory, at least. He loved it because to him it looked like two people with mysterious psychic powers fighting each other with lots of guns. He saw no problem with the film. And that's the way to go to see any film. No one who reads the book Starship Troopers should go see the movie Bug Wars, which had the title Starship Troopers, but I will not dignify it by calling it.
Well, it's kind of like talking to Scott about the Star Trek reboot that J.J. Abrams did, which I'm a big Star Trek fan, watched the original series when it was original and all this stuff. I was a kid, I still like the reboot. Scott, it was a little more different.
They were enjoyable once, is my thing, and I'm annoyed at how they blew everything up that I, you know, it's like you have all this time invested in this universe and then they blew it up and are going a different direction. I found it annoying after the initial watch.
Now, oddly enough, I felt the same dichotomy of reaction to the Star Trek reboot as to this movie, but in that case, it was the opposite. As a writer, I thought the solution of rehashing all the continuity by establishing that this was a separate and parallel timeline was a brilliant writer's trick to free yourself from the constraints of the continuity while keeping anything you wanted from the original timeline.
Mm-hmm.
See, it's very clever. As a viewer, to have Captain James T. Kirk not act like the Kirk that I knew, a guy who hit the books all the time, a guy who was the youngest Starfleet captain ever to make the grade.
Oh, yeah.
A guy who... and to have my favorite character, who I based my entire life after, Spock, suddenly have a girlfriend when it's not a muck time, and that's not on stage. That's not shown to be on stage, where I mean, at least they could have made it Nurse Chapel. She was the one who was sweet on him. Mm. But instead, he robbed us of actually seeing the buildup of the drama of the woman who can melt the ice prince, which is what he was. He's a right. male ice princess. Okay, he's right. he's untouchable. He's unapproachable. Mm. And they didn't do that. And Abrams didn't do that. So I did like some of the Star Wars reboot, but it's not something I would see again twice. I would much rather see, you know, The Matrix again or Jupiter Ascending, which I thought was perfectly.
I have not seen that one yet. I've got to see.
It's not great, but there's a scene where a guy ice skates through midair and the whole city explodes around him that I just thought was visually stunning.
Cool.
You know, but it's not deep. It's not, you know, it's not great, but it's not bad.
Well, those are good movies too.
Yeah.
Every movie can't be genius.
I've got to watch.
As we've just been discussing.
But I wished I liked the Star Wars reboot more. I wish I felt the desire to see it a second time, and I don't. You know?
Mm-hmm.
Whereas the original one I saw dozens of times. The only movie I've seen more than Star Wars is the original Superman with Alexander Siskow on Superman. Hmm. Which I loved, by the way. Loved to pieces. Hmm.
Did you see that the next Star Wars film is not Episode 8?
Oh, what?
Oh, yeah, they're going to do the Bothan stealing the codes of the Death Star to get into the robot.
Right, it's called Rogue One, I think, is what it's called.
That's a great idea. My theory is that the robot is that R2-D2 is actually a hacker, a spy, because he plugs into the light socket and can take over the Empire's computers. Mm-hmm. I mean, come on. It's, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, that would be cool to establish some of that. That's awesome.
Well, I like the idea also of opening it up so that, and I think, Scott, you had mentioned this one time before, of so you could see different characters from different worlds, and they don't have to always be involved with the rebels that way.
Yeah, it's a huge universe. It's a huge universe. I feel like, you know, they're going to go kind of the Marvel direction, and, you know, there's going to be all kinds of movies. I feel like Marvel's in a box right now.
Marvel movies?
Yeah. I mean, with the latest Avengers. I haven't seen one
that was bad.
No. I love them. I love them. But how do you keep ratcheting up the tension? What's left to ratchet?
Yeah, I think
you know what I'm saying?
You're speaking to the right man.
I'm speaking to the right man. All right.
I know exactly how to do what you're talking about.
Disney, come hire John C. Wright.
Please. No. It's a basic trick all writers should know.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. What you do is once you've established a certain thing is the MacGuffin in the first movie, you find out that that enemy is one of a larger group. Let me give you the example. Back in the old pulp days in 1939, Galactic Patrol was written by Doc E. Smith, and in the first book, the enemy is space pirates. Mm-hmm. Okay, at the end of the book, you find out that the space pirates are merely the military arm being funded by a group of evil drug runners who are enormously wealthy and have infiltrated your entire society, okay? At the end of the second book, you find out that the drug runners and the space pirates are merely the psychological arm and the military arm of a race from another galaxy that's attempting to obliterate your entire galaxy. Then at the end of the fourth book, you find out that these creatures are from another dimension and that they're godlike beings who can read your mind and see the future and control reality, and that your side is being secretly helped by creatures equal in status, but much more subtle than they are. You see where I'm going with this?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, sure.
What books are these?
This is the
E. Doc Smith.
The Lensman series by E. Doc
Smith.
And no one can be a science fiction fan who has not read the Lensman series.
Well, I've tried
pure pulp
several times on that first one and just not cared that much.
No, the first one's the third one. That's probably why. I read Galactic Patrol. It's also a girl thing. It's also a guy thing. It's pure testosterone.
Oh, fine. Now that's the gauntlet. I've got to read it now.
Well, start with Galactic Patrol because the books that are previous in time were actually the prequels were written later. I'm one of those guys who insists you can't read Magician's Nephew first. You have to read Lion, Witch, the Wardrobe first.
And we
ignore the numbering. Ignore the numbering on the spine of the books. Yeah. Okay?
Chronological.
Galactic Patrol is the first book, and I'll.
Isn't that where they graduate from the academy and he goes off and he has a bracelet? Yep. Yeah, that's the one I keep getting halfway through and going,
It's
not like that for me.
It's one of my favorite books, and it's not very well written. I mean, I'm sorry. It's full of purple clothes. He was paid by the word. And it shows.
Unlike
but at the time, it was written, no one else had set a story on that scale. No one else had had aliens that were not monsters, that were actually members of a friendly civilization where they had equal rights with the humans. Mm-hmm. No one else had written a story on a galactic scale. Everyone else wrote their stories, you know, basically Mars, Jupiter, or Venus. Right. No one else assumed a multiracial, multi-ethnic crew, which he did, where when he has the Valentians and the humans working hand-in-hand against the space pirates, and so on and so forth. And he was enough of an engineer to know exactly how much energy and power atomic energy would have, yes, which no one else seemed to really understand. I seem to remember that H.G. Wells had London being atom-bombed, and the atom bombs were would blow up a city block, for example. Mm-hmm. But keep in mind, the atomic energy had not been was theoretical when both these men were writing. Well, it didn't exist. Didn't exist yet.
Indeed.
But much as I'm a fan of the Lensman series, it is an acquired taste because things have changed since the 1930s when it was written, and also. But it's hard for me to imagine someone liking Star Wars who would not like the originals from which almost all Star Wars... These books are the first space opera. They're the ones from which all space operas take their inspiration.
Yeah, and I've tried, especially through LibriVox, there are other of his books that are on there, and there's something about his writing I just can't get into it. So he's just one of those guys that I'm gonna have to just be sorry I missed, you know.
That's okay. You're horrible purple prose. I'm not gonna defend it.
I am a fan of purple prose, but just his leaves me cold. What can I say?
Are you sure we're talking about the same Doc E. Smith? Because the only thing I liked about the Abrams movie was that the fact that he blew up the planet Vulcan means that the guy was at the Smith level of space opera. If you write a story where at least one planet is not blown to smithereens, then you don't live up to the level of world wrecker Hamilton, who I already mentioned, world wrecker, who was the husband of Leigh Brackett.
Ah, well, he did that. I hope J.J. Abrams realizes he did that for my husband, who spent the entire time, once he realized that the sun was being sucked into a planet, spent the whole time going, what's going to happen when they breach that compartment that sends everything out? Because if it's holding the power of a sun, everything had better be destroyed. And he was so happy when everything started imploding the way it should. And I was like, okay, honey, for you.
I actually was impressed by the third Death Star, because not only because it had grass and trees and pine trees and snow and glaciers on top of it, on the hull. It was a hollowed-out planet. But the fact that they were fighting on top of it when the thing was blowing itself to pieces and there was earthquakes going on, that was pure pulp. That was pure Doc E. Smith. So don't get me wrong. As much as I hated this movie, I loved it. Loved it to pieces. And the thing eats suns. And you can see, as a writer, you have to appreciate, the sun is going out during the scene. It's getting dimmer and dimmer as the fight
the
is going on.
The symbolism was fantastic. Yeah. The dark Brilliant. Is thickening. Yes.
Brilliant. That's right.
I loved it. And the big chasm that was between them so that they couldn't fight anymore. I'm like, there's more going on in that chasm than just a chasm, people. If I'm wrong, guys, do these people not know how to design a catwalk? Because I'm just going to say, a super narrow catwalk with no handrails above a chasm is not the way to go. And they keep doing it over and over.
Yes.
They keep doing it because the stormtroopers are brave and are not afraid to fall.
Yes. Yeah, we don't need handrails. They're only stormtroopers.
And if they start falling, someone will just flip off the gravity and pull the guy to the side.
And why on earth is, there's so many bottomless pits in Star Wars? They're everywhere.
We've got a sphere. We're not going to fill it in. We're just going to leave it empty and build around the edges, everybody. Yeah.
This is where we're going to put the bottomless pit, fellas.
It's because the corpses of the giant space whelks that they use and this giant space clams that they hollow out to build their stuff into has these long tubules, and they just use it for putting fuel into the central power core, and then they just leave them there because it's too expensive to build them out.
Wow. Okay, I take back anything I was arguing with you about. That's good. We're going on with it then. You know everything.
That's That's a fan save, for goodness sake. One thing I will say is that the extended universe, all the novels and the comics that have been written since Star Wars, these guys have a lot of material to draw from. Now, I realize that they decided not to be tied in, not to be handcuffed to what's been established in that continuity.
Yeah, yeah.
But they could still steal ideas. They have a rich, deposit of faith, if you will, of a whole bunch of story ideas that they could exploit.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, they do. I've read some of that.
One thing I wish they had done, here's part of my problem with this, part of my vexation with the movie is so many of the flaws could have been saved with one line or even one word. One line could have told me what the relationship was between the Republic, the Resistance, and the First Order, for example. Was it half the galaxy was still, you know, like Constantinople, and the other half was like, you know, Rome had fallen and was now Normans? Mm-hmm. Was the Resistance behind enemy lines and being funded by the Republic secretly? Was Princess Leia, you know, cast out because the Republic made a weak and cowardly peace deal with the remaining whoever's claiming to be emperor these days, or just whatever? You could do it in a few lines. So.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Gotcha.
Okay, Lawrence Kasdan, are you listening? I expected more from Mr. Silverado and Mr. Empire Strikes Back.
Yeah. Lawrence Kasdan also wrote the Superman and Green Lantern episodes, the 6-minute-long cartoons from when I was a kid. From the Superman Batman Hour. That's him.
Nice.
Lawrence Kasdan. So he's been around. He's been doing this for a while.
Immortal.
I know. Saw his name, I got pretty excited about the whole thing.
Yeah.
I thought it would be better, and I just assumed that he handed in a script and that J.J. Abrams overruled him and said, let's put in more stupid. Now, once again, I'm being very negative, and yet I want to emphasize, I just still loved this movie. I felt like I was a kid again. I felt like I had been welcomed back into the old house where I used to play when I was 7.
And I think that's the power of the movie, because sitting there, because my husband is 3 years older than me, so he saw it either just at the end of college or right after.
Yeah.
We felt just like we did. And I've heard people say this on podcasts and things. You had the music, you had the crawler, you had the familiar stuff, you had the new things, but you came out going, yeah, that's what I wanted.
Yeah.
It's like, that's it. It's the serial. I wanted a Star Wars movie. Now they can go somewhere new, but this did it. I needed this so much.
Let me say one other thing about that. And I completely agree. When they did episode 1 and the word crawled up, instead of the original Star Wars, the word crawl, I think the first words are something like, it's a time of war or something like that.
Okay.
In the first movie, Revenge of the Pathetic Jar Jar Empire Strikes of the Phantom Menace, I think it was called. A forgettable movie.
Yeah.
The word crawls goes up and says, people are arguing about income tax in the space lanes, and there's some sort of rebellion of the Trade Federation is putting up a blockade because the marginal tax rate is too hot. I'm going, wow, really? Okay, Abrams did not make that mistake. Here's what he did. Luke Skywalker is missing. Okay,
yeah.
Now, spoilers or not, I'm not spoiling anything because that's in the first.
Oh yeah,
that's the first line of the first paragraph of the word crawl. And I thought that guy knows what he's doing. I was wrong about that, but it made me it. His setup was all good, and his follow through is weak. In every case, he had a brilliant idea. Let's have a stormtrooper change sides. Let's have a stormtrooper have a conscience. Brilliant idea, you know?
Yeah.
Let's have one of the Skywalker family regret that Darth Vader lost.
See? Yeah.
And regret that he feels tempted by the good. Brilliant idea. And all my complaints, and I've been whining and kvetching and complaining, are all based on lack of follow through. The setup line is great. The punchline was weak, in every case. But I will say yet again, it's like falling in love with a girl. When you fall in love, you don't see the flaws. You're just in love. It's great.
Mm-hmm.
And everything I'm complaining about is all things that are missed opportunities. I don't think anything in the movie was wrong. I don't think anything in the movie was bad. I just think the writing was a little weak. But
I wanted it to be better.
I wanted it to be at least as tight as. Your average Star Trek episode from when I was a kid.
Now, wait a minute, because I remember one where there was an Indian princess and Shatner took his shirt off, yes, again, while he wore a feather on his head. And I'm saying this was better than that, okay?
That one had a giant asteroid coming toward the planet, and they had to figure out how to decipher an ancient monument before the asteroid destroyed them. So I think that one was still pretty good.
No, you cannot destroy that other image. I'm sorry.
I am Kira!
Good luck.
Oh, yeah. I know exactly which episode you're talking about and what the star date was.
Yes, I was impressed. But you have to admit, I was able to pull that one up too, so high five.
Very nice.
Yield to no man. I also wanted to say that when you brought up that Kylo Ren, you know, is sorry that his grandfather chose wrongly, as he thought, you know, and he's fighting against the light. Yep. And that made me, when he was, you know, you see the skull and the helmet and everything, you're like, ugh, but, or I guess it's just the helmet. But anyway, it made me remember that in the third movie, the first trilogy, I was really upset that Darth Vader was not taken down because I hated him so much for all those movies that when Luke Skywalker showed compassion and understood and helped him come back, and I kind of went, I understood and everything, and the Emperor died, but that wasn't enough. And it wasn't until watching this movie that I realized, I was like, oh, I've completely changed how I would look at that now, because, you know, I wasn't Catholic then, and I am now. Now I look at it and see a beautiful redemption story and all this other stuff, but just as a regular person, I was like, he was bad, I want him to die. And I just thought that was kind of an interesting internal shift on my part, you know? Hmm. Yeah, it was awful. I'm just saying.
I do think that when Vader turns out to be, spoilers, the father of Skywalker in the second movie, the movie suddenly takes on the stature of a Greek tragedy. And in the third movie, it turns out to be a movie about redemption, which is the last thing you're expecting. Mm-hmm. Because you don't expect, you know, Space Hitler to suddenly go, oh, my son, you know, and then, sorry about the Holocaust, because I, with this ship, killed more people on planet Alderaan than all the world wars put together. But hey, but he touched something much deeper. So he grew beyond the mere space opera that he started with.
Yeah,
I do think people talk about the mythology of Star Wars and the Hero with a Thousand Faces of Joseph Campbell that George Lucas referred to. Mm-hmm. I myself am, since I'm a bitter and skeptical man, was skeptical of the claim, because it was pretty clear to me he was making Buck Rogers.
Yeah.
But that by the time the second and third movie rolled around, he did get more depth to it, and he did do exactly the kind of thing that I said is what you have to do if you want to have a sequel, both be the same meal again and a new meal, and a different, you know, I want a hamburger like I had before, but this time I want the hamburger to be, you know, made of ice cream. You see, which I think he did with the second and third movie.
Yeah. Yeah, I saw a recent George Lucas interview with Charlie Rose. It's like within the last few weeks. Mm-hmm. And he said that, you know, when he made the first Star Wars movie, he didn't know that he was going to get to make any more.
Yeah.
And that he took the story and compressed it and dropped a lot of it into one movie. And then once they wanted to make more, or, you know, he had the opportunity, he had problems like, the Death Star is still, the Death Star is gone. I've got to solve that problem, you know. So that's why we had the second Death Star and things. So whatever he had come up with as a whole, he didn't know he was going to make. And so I found that interesting. Yeah,
that's why Star Wars is a complete self-contained story, whereas Empire Strikes Back, although I like it better, is not. Empire Strikes Back ends on a cliffhanger to be continued in our next.
Yeah, yeah.
3 years from now. Or whatever.
Right. Yeah. Well, cool.
Exactly.
All right. Well, wow. I think we should end her right there. What do you say?
Yep.
I think we should do it to be continued, because as we have to know, all good stories end with to be continued.
That's right. That's right.
Because he's coming back.
Uh-huh. absolutely. Well, it's been a genuine pleasure, and thank you for joining us.
I would like to thank you, and also like to ask an apology from Mrs. Davis, because it seems to me that many people say that I don't try to browbeat people or come across too aggressive, and sometimes people say I'm a little too aggressive, and when that happens, I kill them and bury their bodies under the floorboards. But it's not that I hated the old man. It was his eye. It was like the eye of a bird of prey. So I just wanted to say, if I was interrupted you too often, I apologize, but it's probably going to happen again. Because
no.
as a Catholic, I both ask for repentance and I know I'm going to do it again.
Well, see, this is perfect, because when you dropped out for a little while, I was asking Scott, oh my gosh, was I too snippy? I kept interrupting. So we both are the same, obviously. So I ask for your forgiveness also.
I didn't notice whether you interrupted me or not. It's because everyone talks at once in my family, so it's just what I'm used to.
Fantastic. I thought it went wonderfully. I hope everybody enjoyed it.
I enjoyed it a lot.
I enjoyed this tremendously, so much so that I'd like to beg you on my knees to let me do this again at some point.
Fantastic.
Lots of other books and movies that we could talk about. We didn't even touch on Flash Gordon or Star Trek. You guys probably talked about Star Trek many times, though.
We have done Star Trek.
Was an epic episode.
Thanks, everybody, for listening.
Yeah, and let's see, the next book is...
The next book, Frankenstein. By Mary Shelley.
Oh, Scott, you choose the best books.
Oh, it's a good one.
Yeah, and I'm just going to warn everyone now that we are going to attempt in the fall of this year to talk about Dante's Divine Comedy. It will be a short, shallow talk, but it will be a talk.
Yeah, we'll leave 15 minutes at the end of an episode to talk about...
I should warn you that Victor von Frankenstein is a bit of an emo, you know, self whiny, wimpy character. So not like Dante, who is tough. Just telling you.
Excellent.
Victor is he's a very modern kind of guy that way.
Yeah, that's right. All right. Well, thanks for everybody.
Yeah, have a great couple of weeks, and we'll talk to you again soon.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye-bye.